And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when there is a great and powerful and overwhelmingly emotional reaction to the terrible news of seven aid workers being killed by a strike by the Israel Defense Forces, a strike which has been described by Prime Minister Netanyahu as a great tragedy. It has been described as unintentional. But what this makes for is a headline that everyone should take into advisement. The headline says, Israel takes responsibility. Who else does? It's a column by Matthew Hennessy, who is the deputy op-ed editor of the Wall Street Journal. Matthew, thanks very much for making time for us. Have you been surprised by any aspects of the public reaction, or particularly of the Israeli government reaction, to this horrible development?
Well, I'm not surprised by the public reaction. General public, the media and commentators generally tend to hold Israel to a different standard than they hold other countries. I am sort of surprised by Israel's reaction to this terrible and tragic mistake. It's the reason why I wrote this piece. You don't often see anyone, much less a powerful military or a powerful government, taking responsibility for its mistakes. The phrase, we take responsibility, you often hear in regard to terrorist attacks when the IRA or Hamas blows up innocent people sitting at a lunch counter. You know, they issue a statement taking responsibility, but you rarely get, you know, a powerful government from a country in the West making a military mistake like this and coming right out and saying, look, we screwed up, and we're very sorry, and it's a fog of war situation. Accidents are going to happen. This is a war that's been going on for 6 months. Obviously, innocent people are going to get killed here and there. It happens every time there's a war. But what we're not going to do is we're not going to pretend it didn't happen. We're not going to spin. We're not going to delay and hope that 3 weeks from now we can issue a statement taking responsibility and everyone will have forgotten. So pretty remarkable. They came right out and said, we messed up and we're very, very sorry, and we're going to try and figure out how it happened, and we're going to be transparent about it. And I think that that's worthy of praise, because, you know, I love my country, but we've made mistakes in the past, in the not too distant past, of a similar nature. I'm thinking specifically of the incident in Afghanistan in the late summer of 2021, when, you know, we droned a family of 10 a couple of weeks after the Kabul airport bombing. That killed Americans. And, you know, the American government apparatus was not quick to set things straight. There, you know, the media had to sort of dig and do some freedom of information requests to get the truth about that attack. So governments don't like to admit when they're wrong, especially when people die. It's rare and notable, therefore, that Israel has done just that.
Do you believe that this takes away any chance of Israel finishing the war as Netanyahu and his government would define it, which would involve going into Rafah and either capturing or forcing a surrender or eliminating the remaining four battalions of fighters who are involved with Hamas?
No, I don't think it will. You know, my understanding of this situation is that the world, and Washington especially, has somewhat misread the political will of the Israeli people to finish this job. I'm not talking about the Israeli government. I'm not talking about the war cabinet. And they certainly share that view. But their view reflects the will of the Israeli people, who overwhelmingly support going into Rafah to root out the remaining Hamas terrorists who are hiding there. I mean, this whole business will have been a complete waste of time and energy and money and life if that's not accomplished, because as you and your listeners can, you know, probably figure out for themselves, we'll be right back where we started from on October 6th.
Hamas has promised it. They've promised that there will be other attacks like October 7th. If they are given the opportunity to survive until that basis and to stage more massacres.
Yeah, I mean, only somebody who's been living under a rock for the last 30 or 40 years would think that they would simply pack up shop and go away. I mean, their purpose is very clearly stated in their charter, which is to drive Israel into the sea, from the river to the sea. Means precisely that. So if you don't finish the job in Rafah, you'll just be right back at this point in the mountain a few months or a few years from now. So I don't think that the Israelis will be dissuaded from finishing the job. The actual details of how it's done, well, I mean, you know, obviously there's the easy way and the hard way. And so because of all of the political turmoil and managing their sponsor, if you want to look at it that way, managing the expectations of the American, their American allies, it may have to be done in a suboptimal way, but I think it will be done.
And in terms of accomplishing those war aims, the release of all the hostages and the elimination of Hamas as an immediate terrorist threat, what's the future that you would anticipate for this strip of land called Gaza, which the Israelis originally abandoned in 2005?
Wow. Well, that's the $64,000 question. I mean, what happens after? If I had to guess, I would have to guess that this is going to be Israel's problem for a very long time. They're going to have to reoccupy Gaza. They're going to have to, you know, get down into the sand, as it were, and try to rebuild a civil society and a government that they can live alongside from scratch. And it's going to have to be, you know, completely sans Hamas, obviously. But whether or not that's possible, it sure doesn't seem like it is. There's so much street level support for Hamas and for, you know, permanent jihad in the Palestinian psyche, that I'm not sure that. Listen, if it was an easy problem, somebody would have figured it out by now. I don't have an answer for that one.
Right. The terrible thing also is that this event only fuels the very angry and increasingly openly anti-Semitic pro-Hamas sentiment here in the United States. Though they didn't win a huge victory in the Wisconsin primary yesterday, where they were trying to show opposition and hostility to the Biden administration because it hasn't abandoned Israel.
And I don't think it will abandon Israel. I think that there is, quite a bit of fortitude in Biden himself for supporting Israel. I think that, in so much as he's leading the government, open question. The policy will remain what it seems to have become, which is, you know, quiet support for Israel, public, wrist slaps from time to time when they screw up to appease our restive left flank. I think ultimately this conflict is not going to be finished by November. So, I just can't imagine that the kinetic military operation might be finished, but the larger problem we were just discussing will remain long past November. So whatever short-term political benefit Biden sees in, chastising Israel and taking a hard line and publicly lambasting Netanyahu and the rest of the government, I think that eventually Israel will be able to rely, as it always has, on its American ally.
God willing. Matthew Hennessy, the deputy op-ed editor at the Wall Street Journal. His piece is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. And on the Michael Medved Show, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the show Tom Nichols, who wrote a book that became a tremendous bestseller some years ago. There is a new edition of the book, and because it's more pertinent than ever before, the book is called The Death of Expertise, the subtitle, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge. Tom Nichols is professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval War College, where he taught for some quarter of a century. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic magazine and the author of numerous other books, including Our Own Worst Enemy. The Death of Expertise is released today and already an Amazon bestseller. Congratulations on this, Tom. But when you talk about the death of expertise, is there been more rigor mortis that has set in to expertise since your first edition came out?
Sadly, yes. And thank you, Michael. And thank you so much for having me. I mean, part of why there's a second edition, you know, I suppose I should have subtitled it, "Didn't you hear me the first time?" But actually,
but I told you before, right?
Yeah, I keep telling you, you know, volume three, one more time. But I think part of the problem is that I just didn't see that that anti-expertise populism would become central to an American political party. I predicted in, you know, years ago when I wrote the first one, I first wrote about this about 10 years ago, and then the first book came out in early 2017. And I said, well, if there's a depression or a war or a pandemic, you know, that tends to snap people out of this, that they then say, okay, well, you know, after World War II, you know, all the experts go to Bretton Woods and they set up a financial system. And, you know, during a pandemic,
we have real problems beyond QAnon.
Right. Exactly. And this didn't happen this time. This time, it actually, you know, people decided where they stood on scientific expertise based on their tribal affiliations, their pre-existing political and tribal affiliations. And that made things worse, and that persists to this day. I mean, if you look at things like vaccination rates and illness and trust in science, it is still basically a partisan issue now, and that's unfortunate.
Okay, the point is you have the subtitle, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge, but you also refer to expertise. And Isn't there an automatic kind of a knee-jerk reaction among many, many Americans of all political perspectives that when somebody is proclaimed as an expert, he's part of an elite? A lot of this is anti-elitism, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I wrote the first edition, I said, this is a book whose title is immediately going to annoy you, you know, and kind of annoy people in general. But you know, it didn't always used to be that way, that we once understood the division of labor in this country. We, especially in the 50s and 60s, which when we were living through a time of, you know, what seemed like scientific miracles, right? I mean, it's the old cliche about managing to put a man on the moon. The problem with expertise is that by its nature, it's exclusive. You know, if you're standing in a room of 50 people and only one of you is a doctor, well, then there's only one medical expert. If only one of you is an electrician, well, there's only one electrical expert. And, you know, that person should probably put in the wiring. And people in this day and age, and I keep talking about narcissism in the book, in this day and age, people don't want to be told that they're not capable of something. That's why they dog experts when they're working. When I had my house redone after a fire, even the guys that were doing the painting said, "Oh yeah, we get that all the time." People come in and say, "Now why are you using that? What's that paint? You know, why would you use that?" And these guys are like, "Look, we paint houses. We know what we're doing." And that goes right all the way up to, you know, molecular biologists and diplomats and doctors and everybody else. And I think it's part of a social malady that's overtaken the country and the world, I think. Again, unfortunately.
Okay. When you talk about what's ironic to me is that there are several voices in this remaining presidential campaign that are very hostile to expertise or very hostile to what you call established knowledge. And it's not just Donald Trump. There's a guy named Robert Kennedy who, if anything, comes from about the most elite background you could imagine. But he's all about the death of expertise, isn't he? And not just on vaccines.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Kennedy, you know, Donald Trump is an anti-expertise populist for a lot of reasons. One is that he's an unbelievable narcissist who thinks he's the smartest guy about everything, as we've seen. You know, the guy who says, I could tell the doctors and the generals and everybody else how to do their business.
Well, wait, Kennedy, hold on. Well, he has an uncle who taught at MIT, right?
Yeah, right. Because it's in the genes. But Kennedy, I think, is just an, I think he's just a crackpot. I think he fell down these rabbit holes years ago, because Kennedy's been this way a long time. You know, he didn't just adopt these attitudes when he decided to run for president. He's, you know, this is a guy who thinks that, you know, water is turning kids gay and, you know, believes every conspiracy theory and advocates for many of them, you know, every conspiracy theory that comes down the pike. But I think people find that empowering, Michael. They say, I don't really understand what's going on. The world's a complicated place. And this reassuring figure, whether it's, you know, Trump or Kennedy or anybody else, comes forward and says, listen, I know the conspiracy. I know the secret. I'll help you get through this. I know the secret knowledge. And people gravitate toward that, because they're scared or they're confused, and, you know, there's a certain amount of epistemic chaos in the world, and it's just easier to have somebody say, I can explain all this, rather than to say it's complicated and nuanced and you need to learn a few things.
And basically it's not that I can explain all of this. I can fix all of this by dismantling the structures that we have to try to solve problems. There's an an AMA survey that shows that over 96% of doctors have been fully vaccinated. The question of vaccination, isn't there incredibly good evidence that it's bad for people to shun vaccinations, and it's precisely the rate of vaccination that impacts different states and localities and nations in terms of avoiding fatal results from COVID-19. We'll get to that and to more with Tom Nichols. His new edition is just out, The Death of Expertise, second edition, with new and different and important material. We will be right back.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
It's an honor to talk to you, because I think you got the best talk show in the United States.
Thank you. I agree.
This is The Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment. The Michael Medved Show.
2017, which seems like another era when you look back to it, it's not really that long ago. New book came out, became a bestseller, was universally praised and widely popular. The book was called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Now there's a second issue of the book, which by Tom Nichols, who is our guest. And the second edition of the book includes all kinds of material, bringing the world up to date on some of the war on expertise that made the COVID-19 pandemic so much worse than it needed to be. And then also information about, Trumpism. And not yet about the new campaign and how it turns out. But today there was a audio collage put together, I believe, by Mr. Filikowski, who's done a bunch of these. But this indicates the extraordinary depth of knowledge on the part of President Trump on a wide range of subjects or pursuits. Listen.
Nobody knows this stuff better than me.
Nobody knows more about taxes than I do and income than I do.
Nobody knows more about construction than I do.
Nobody knows more about campaign finance than I do.
I know more about drones than anybody.
Nobody knows much more about technology, this type of technology, certainly, than I do.
Nobody knows more about technology than me.
Nobody in the history of this country has ever known so much about infrastructure as Donald Trump.
I know the H-1B. I know the H-2B. Nobody knows it better than me.
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me.
I understand things. I comprehend very well, okay? Better than, I think, almost anybody.
How does that apply, Tom, to the death of expertise?
Wow. You know, you think you've gotten used to it, and then you hear it all together, and you say, you know, if you ran into a guy like this at a bar, you'd change seats. I mean, you'd just go somewhere else. but, it's a problem because what Trump is just a very extreme version of what a lot of Americans have become, who, you know, when you talk to them about, again, you know, any engineering, medicine, diplomacy, nuclear weapons, you name it, people say, oh, no, I understand that. And there was a time where people were humble enough to say, look, I don't understand it. So that's why I ask people who know more about this than I do. You know, you pointed out that there were a lot of bad outcomes with people who were the most in areas that were heavily voted for Trump. Because these are folks that said, I don't need to take vaccines. I understand disease. I understand how this works. There's a line in the book. There's a whole new chapter in the book about COVID. And there's a line in the book where a group of medical and policy experts, a bipartisan group, looked at this. And one of them said, in the end, Trump was a comorbidity, that basically Trumpism was basically a risk factor for dying from this. But I do talk about in the book that the experts made mistakes as well. Experts are human. They screw up. But part of being an expert is not to walk out there and say, well, I know everything there is to know about engineering and bankruptcy and finance and campaign reform and so on. Trump has really encouraged people to think that way.
In terms of beyond the death of expertise and its impact on the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact generally on public health, measles popping up again and in other places, and polio popping up again. What is the other most obvious damage that you can point to from the death of expertise recently?
I think the biggest ongoing problem is how many people now, because they assume that they can be the kind of fair judge of what's true and what's not, that they don't trust any sources anymore about anything. And that's really where a country starts to slide into authoritarianism, because people will believe everything and nothing at the same time. And so, the idea that there are even facts, that some things are true, some things are false. People have just left that aside to say, I live in my own reality. I make those judgments for myself every day because I am actually capable of doing that. And I think that, you know, you could point to 100 different cases about that, anything from, you know, people not trusting weather forecasts and not evacuating their homes to people not getting vaccinated or people coming up with, I could solve the Middle East tomorrow. I could solve Ukraine tomorrow. And they don't realize that these are actually difficult things to do. And I think that has a terrible effect on our politics.
Or you when can put, start to think you can put up a border wall on day one of your administration or seal the border immediately by pulling
and
that
Mexico
big lever under the desk. And Mexico will pay for it all. Of all the recent conspiracy theories, populist conspiracy theories, which one strikes you as the most ludicrous?
Oh, boy, that's a great question, Michael. I don't know. I mean, I always like the one about, Bill Gates putting nanobots in vaccines. That's kind of one of my favorites.
What about that we didn't go to the moon, that the whole space program
is a fake? That one's been around for
But, you know, that's been around for a long time.
Yes, but look at all the proof that they found.
Yeah, so when you look through your telescope and see the remaining of the remnants of the lunar lander, clearly they're just props that we shot up there and you know, landed on the surface. You and I are old enough to remember a great movie called Capricorn One, you know, which you may recall, but which was all about a faked Mars landing, and that was back in the 70s. There are dangerous ones. I mean, obviously QAnon is a very dangerous, very, you know, off the wall conspiracy. But if you're asking me sort of my personal, you know, favorite, I suppose the idea that we figured out how to put little teeny tiny microchips into vaccines, which of course does not explain why doctors and all of the supposed elites are lining up to get these vaccines. If we're the ones that know what's in it, we wouldn't be doing it. No one said these things have to make sense.
Right. Well, they often don't. What's the best direction for the country to come back to reality and the recognition that sometimes you need experts to help solve pressing problems?
I think if people took a deep breath and stepped back and realized how much they rely on experts, including other people often relying on them. Look, if you're a bus driver, you're an expert. You have a bus driver's license. You are qualified and examined to drive a big piece of machinery with small children in it. You know, people rely on you to do that. If you're an electrician, if you're a plumber, if you're a doctor, if you're a, you know, foreign service officer, I think that people have, as you said earlier, they identify expert with elite, and they don't realize that we count on each other all day long for our expertise. And I think people need to kind of grow up and step back and take a deep breath and think about the way that we, you know, trusted each other in an earlier time, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and the way our parents might have thought about this. I think a certain amount of humility and a certain amount of, you know, kind of a sense of humor of stepping back and saying, you know, yeah, I probably don't understand vaccines. Maybe I ought to just ask my doctor.
And if you can't ask a doctor, ask Tom Nichols. He has brought out the updated and expanded new edition released today of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Tom, always a pleasure speaking with you. Let's hope we all survive this election and the American experiment comes out with successful results for the future. More on that and other topics of profound concern coming up on The MedVet Show.
There is just one reality left. We are here and it is now. You get hold of that and hang on to it. You might as well be.
The MedVet Show now with Congress getting ready to come back and to face a number of challenges. There's a whole new controversy that is going to be dividing the House of Representatives. It's written about in Mediaite. I was actually kind of surprised to hear this because usually you don't have a whole group of members of Congress getting together to introduce legislation. Legislation that might be a bit polarizing. Let me explain. Mediaite writes, in the race among Republicans to suck up to former President Donald Trump, who is the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, 7 GOP members of Congress are bidding to take the lead. Representative Guy Reschenfelter, Republican of Pennsylvania, has introduced a bill along with 6 co-sponsors to rename Washington's Dulles Airport the Donald J. Trump International Airport. Representatives Chuck Fleischman, Republican of Tennessee, Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, Barry Moore, Republican of Alabama, Troy Nails, Republican of Texas, Andy Ogles, Republican of Tennessee, and Michael Waltz, Republican of Florida, have all signed on. Where's Matt Gaetz? Would have expected him to be there. And no Marjorie Taylor Greene, not yet anyway. In my lifetime, our nation has never been greater than under the leadership of President Donald J. Trump, Congressman Rosenthaler said. As millions of domestic and international travelers fly through the airport, I'm sort of imagining them flying through the airport. It gets you to your gate on time. I think he means as they fly through the airport, there is no better symbol of freedom, prosperity, and strength than hearing, "Welcome to Trump International Airport," as they land on American soil. Representative Moore, one of the co-sponsors, referenced the fact that D.C.'s other airport was renamed to honor a former president. It used to be National Airport. And then in 1998, they renamed National Airport in Washington after one of our other great presidents, Ronald Reagan. That's what Moore told Fox News. It is only fitting that we would do the same for another of our very greatest presidents, Donald J. Trump, especially as he stands against the onslaught of weaponized government to fight for Americans like us. The bill has a tough road in the Democratic-controlled Senate, but a House vote could potentially force some swing district GOP members into an awkward show of loyalty to the former president. This sounds like a parody. It's not a parody. It's very real. And meanwhile, there is a lot more about Trump. Some of it, which is parodistic, and some of it, well, which is from unlikely and complicated sources. For instance, Hillary Clinton was on the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and she gave her perspective on the race between Biden and Trump. Here is the former Secretary of State, former First Lady, clip 13.
I mean, it's Biden versus Trump.
Yes,
we know that.
It is.
What do you say to voters who are upset that those are the two choices?
Get over yourself. Those are the two choices.
Yeah, love that.
Right? And you know, it's kind of like one is old and effective and compassionate, has a heart and really cares about people, and one is old and has been charged with 91 felonies.
Interesting.
I don't understand why this is even a hard choice, really.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But we have to go through the election, and hopefully people will realize what's at stake, because it's an existential question. What kind of country we're going to have, what kind of democracy we're going to have. And people who blow that off are not paying attention, because it's not like Trump, his enablers, his empowerers, his allies are not telling us what they want to do. I mean, they're pretty clear about what kind of country they want.
For some people, they look at some of the statements and some of the promises that President Trump has made, and promising that he will be justice and retribution for the American people. A lot of people who think they've been getting a raw deal, a lot of people who think that their values, particularly when it comes to religious values, are being shunned and disgraced and undermined and basically belittled. Those people are eager to strike back. And Hillary Clinton, I'm not sure when she's in that setting on The Tonight Show what kind of answer one would expect or would work better. But on another late night show, the other Jimmy Kimmel, had some words about the night insurance owner who loaned Trump his bond money. Listen, this is clip 7.
Donald Trump pulled a rabbit out of his MAGA hat. He managed to post that $175 million bond he couldn't get. He got one courtesy of the Knight Specialty Insurance Company, which I'm guessing did not Google the phrase, "Who is Donald Trump?" Somewhere there's a loan officer who just got called into his boss's office. You loaned $175 million to who? This is the man with the good sense to loan a lot of money to Donald Trump. There he is, the next owner of Mar-a-Lago, billionaire Don Hanke, also known as the king of the subprime car loans. Don Hanke, he sells loans to people with less than exceptional credit. Forbes said his company repossesses about 250 cars a day. Our former president got a loan from a repo man.
Again, this is interesting. There's also this report from Bloomberg. Their senior executive editor, Tim O'Brien, was on MSNBC. And he was bringing up the new and surprising news that even before they can rename the airport, the Dulles Airport, which is named after John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State in the Eisenhower administration. In any event, concerning the Bloomberg senior editor, he's writing about the breaking news that the original partners who founded Truth Social with Donald Trump are now being sued by Donald Trump. How does this work? Listen.
You know, I would argue, actually, that I think he's got a bigger platform than he ever had on The Apprentice now, unfortunately. I think, you know, but prior to The Apprentice, he was regarded as this footnote to jokes about the excesses of the 1980s. And he sort of wandered in the wilderness, and he was a curiosity on gossip pages, and he wasn't taken seriously. Then he lands on The Apprentice, and he's converted into this sort of entrepreneurial savant, which he never was. He was a serial bankruptcy artist.
Yeah.
And then he basically takes that act to the White House. And I do think that that is part the Trump cult is built on this idea that he is a can-do businessman and he's going to lead his followers to the promised land.
Yeah.
Now, you know, his partners in Truth Social are suing him, but he's suing them back in a separate court. He doesn't want them to have any piece of the pie of a business they brought to his doorstep.
A business that's losing money.
Yeah, a fly-by-night business that, you know, has revenues that most businesses could make in a bake sale. And lost bucket loads of money last year, and the stock price is getting hammered, and the whole thing's business plan is predicated on the idea that Trump will become president, and then his posts on the site will have value. But between now and then, he's running to find money to pay court judgments, and he's not going to let any people that he's in business with get a piece of the pie, which is why he's suing them. That's also vintage Trump.
Okay, that, again, is extraordinary. But there's so much going on that's extraordinary, including a potential World War III. We'll be speaking to Michael Rubin of American Enterprise Institute about how Iran is likely to respond to the killing of some of their leading terrorist generals from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And we'll be speaking to David French about the dangers of making politics into religion. That and more in this greatest nation on God's